5 minutes till 2 in the afternoon. Interviewee is Joseph John Marino. Interviewer, Mary Michael.
They start off 1931. Then I started traveling down along the border. Before that, I traveled out in the desert with many climbers and been a little practicing the things I had learned from my father about survival. And the depression had sort of beginning to really hit me then. And jobs were scarce, money was scarce. $1.50 a day was about the standard wages. Now, since 1926, my father had been telling me once in a while I'd come in from work on Saturday, clean up, and I'd go to a show or go around with my friends and play a little poker or go to a dance or something. And my father kept saying, there you go, throwing away your money, save your money, save your money. Times are coming when people are going to be crossing the street looking for a piece of bread. Well, he preached this so much for a year or so, I finally asked him, what am I supposed to do? He did mention hard, real hard times were coming. Well, he says, go to the farmlands, where the farming, like in Pearl Valley, the San Joaquin Valley, and where they do a lot of farming. When the farmer becomes hungry, he says a professional will starve to death. This is his saying. Well, I found it to be true. Naturally, around farm, especially if he had a family, which I didn't, but I could always find something to eat. And then, we've done a lot of irrigating, there's a lot of wild greens like an impaled ladder. I'd learned quite a bit by 1930-31. In the Chabuco Canyon, I had found a lot of wild things that my father had told me were good eating, such as the yucca, bloom, and stock. Well, also, by this time, I also, from people in the Imperial Valley, from Indians and natives there, I had learned how to survive out in the desert and what to look for in the desert for food. So, I was pretty well prepared for what was coming. The depression really began to hit me around 31, where I couldn't find the work, and I had gone into Imperial Valley and back home again. My niece, my sister's daughter, had married when my father died. Shortly after that, I sent my sister to Douglas. She was anxious to go see her daughter. She'd married. That is my niece. A young boy from Chihuahua who would later become a citizen. Here. One day I found him in a restaurant where I used to board, and he told me that my sister had sent him down there after me. I thought he had a car. I said, where'd you put your car? When we were alone, a lot of his old friends were around, he said, I don't have a car. He said, I came on a freight train. I said, all right, my sister didn't have to send you down here for me to get on a freight train and go. I haven't traveled much by freight train, but it's okay. So I and my brother-in-law, my other sister's husband, drive us to Colton, and there we caught a freight train. Now, mind you, riding freight trains was pretty free at that time. Because of the Depression, so many people traveling around that the government had asked the state, and then later, federal government, I asked the railroad companies to allow people to ride. Turned out there was maybe 3 or 4 million people traveling by freight train here and there, including whole families, children and all. Well, we headed for Douglas, Arizona. 3 trips on into Douglas. Well, we were there for a while in the end of 1931. I got a job in the Chiricahua Mountains, the old stamping ground of Cochise. and his people in Chiricahua. Now there's some, I went to work at Long John Canyon, and just about 5 miles above the entrance of the canyon where the headquarters of a cattle ranch was. Now these people that have these cattle ranches, John Long Canyon and Turkey Canyon, were descendants of people who had been living in the Chiricahua just shortly before, shortly after the Apaches were finally taken down, were brought to peace. But they'd been dealing with the Apaches before that, but I don't remember the name of these ranchers there. Anyway, I worked there 42 days. I was making $1.50 a day. That was the best I could do. We got 10 cents a log cutting timber. The log had to be from 12 inches, not over 16 inches thick. And there had to be special trees that we cut down. The forestry department sent a man over to mark the trees. There'd been a forest fire there. All these trees had been singed, scorched. So we're going to cut those down, cut them into logs, not longer than 12 feet long. And we got 10 cents a log. Now, the ranger would designate a spot where we had to drag the limbs of these trees. Now, imagine a tree with limbs that weighed 300-400 pounds. We had to chop them up in pieces in order to drag them to this designated spot, where they would, in case of a fire, where they wouldn't, you know, they catch fire, they wouldn't spread. Well, I spent 42 days there. There's where I heard a wolf howl. And the boss said I was lying, that he didn't know what I was talking about. He didn't like me. But eventually it proved a cowboy that came up from a ranch from below, cattle ranch. I asked him about 2 weeks later if there's any moles in those mountains. He got kind of excited and he said, yes, there's supposed to be 11 of them here, or 10. He says, I shot one. The cattlemen here have hired or called for a federal hunter. 11 of them came in from Chihuahua. Apparently real cold weather up in the Sierra Madre or something, or hunters drove them out or something. Drove them out of there into Arizona. Well, I was riding in a country where the Apaches had been very active. Like I say, the Chiricahuas was their old stamping ground. John Long was not exactly where they lived. I'd lived in other spots, but these were some places where they'd had some action there with the American soldiers. Sometime later, I found out that my grandfather, my mother's father, had joined the California Volunteers, and he campaigned in those, somewhere around those places in Arizona. I was up in the Chiricahua up 32 days. I climbed a mountain looking for old grandpa. It was a deer that had been nicknamed old grandpa. For 8 years, hunters had been trying to get him. They couldn't. And I made up my mind I was going to get him. I had one chance, a musket. Anyway, I don't think I would have shot him. It's a beautiful creature. Big, old, and wise. I had tamed the deer down. I used tricks that the Indians used. I'd been taught by the Indians, some Indians that I had met, how they hunted, how they would tame the deer. When you run into a group of deer, five or six maybe, does and fawns and maybe a buck, when you saw them, they'd see you, say you'd startle them, you'd see them suddenly. The deer would start running away from you, run the other way. Like you were frightened of them. Then you'd stop. The deer wouldn't see you far enough, they'd stop, turn around and look at you. Little by little, I would get closer and closer. Got to within 25, 30 feet of a doe with a fawn. All this in between when I was on Sunday, say, when I'd borrow a 30-30 rifle and go hunting. I was looking for a pig. There was a herd of wild pigs in the in those mountains that had gone, well, pigs that had gone wild from ranches. And I was out looking for the young pig. I'd been told, don't kill a big boar because you won't be able to eat the meat. It's too strong. Well, I followed a herd of pigs. I could hear them through the brush, climbing up mountains, knocking over lechuguilla. That's a kind of a century plant that the Apaches used to make their mezcal out of, the liquor. Or roast, cut the leaves off and roast them in pits and eat it. It's very sweet, very tasty stuff. Yeah. But anyway, I'd come to where these pigs had turned over these century plants, but I could never hear them ahead of me. I never did catch up with them. Now, inclined to catch up with these pigs, I went up over a ridge, and nosing around. I wasn't paying attention to what I was doing. I slipped and went over a ridge, a very steep, about a 40-degree angle, snow, sliding snow. And I went down with a few, this is pretty close to timberline, a few small pines. I lost my hat, I lost my rifle, and as I'd go by a tree, I'd grab a limb, maybe snap the limb off and hit the next one, and trying to swing my body around to catch myself. Because I knew below, at the end of this snowslide, there was a cliff about 75 foot high, sharp rocks down below. If I went by that, that was it. Well, near the edge, there was one of these century plants, a big one. Luckily, it was bent over towards the edge of the cliff. Otherwise, I'd have been stabbed. It has real sharp thorns, very hard. The leaves are not very long of this type of century plant. They're not very long, but they're very stiff. Well, lucky it was bent the other way. Well, all I could do was I grabbed the last pine, it slowed me down, and I opened my legs, and I hooked that century plant, and it stopped me. Well, I just laid there, spitting out snow, rubbing it out of my face, and catching my breath. Finally, I started up the slope. I take my heel and kick a step in the snow and then put my foot in it and kick another one. I kept going up, always going towards the trees. I'm wondering what I'm going to do with that rifle. Where's that rifle? Well, eventually I found my hat, part covered with snow, picked it up, shook it out, put it on, and climbed about halfway up the slope. It was about 140 feet I had slid down. Here I looked around to my right, and I saw rocks way back. The sun was shining into that. It was crystal clear ice about 5-6 feet thick, and I could see the rocks in behind where the sun would shine on it. It made a beautiful picture to me. Anyway, further up the slope, I saw a little black dot in the snow. I dug around, and it was the tip of the rifle. I pulled it out and shook it down, shook the snow out of it. Then I made my way up to the top of the cliff on the slide, to the ridge. I went way above timberline and then down again. Coming down is where I had discovered, or by reading sign, what I had heard from old timers from up north, from say Wyoming and those states. Up north where they have wolf hunters from around Canada, where they had told me, then I had read an article too in a Western magazine, where wolves will take up with two coyotes or enslave them. The coyotes run the game down and the wolf kills it, and then he eats and then the coyotes eat. In other words, the wolf will kill something the coyotes can't, so they both eat. And the coyotes will run down something like the wolf alone can't do it. Coyotes run in relays to catch a... If they're following a deer, this I learned from this Pima Indian that we were more or less raised with. And He said that a deer was running a circle, not very far from where he's born or raised, or he's, you know, feeding around it. And the coyote knew this, and one will chase him, get him running, and then he'll cut across. So when he finally caught him, the deer stops to fight, well, then the wolf comes up and kills. Well, this is by tracking. I was heading down for a spot we call a rincon, called in Spanish, or hoya in Indian. It's one tribe of Indian calls it a hoya, and it's a sort of a little corner in the, up in the mountains where there's trees sheltered corner and flat ground, feeding ground for the deer and where they sleep night sometimes. Well, the wolf and the coyotes had been ahead of me, so I knew there was no deer down there. So I came back to camp. I heard something in that mountain. I was alone this one day, down in camp. The boss had sent me down to make some single trees. We had the iron for it and a lot of scrub oak, and I knew just how to do it, so I made making these single trees. Made a homemade forge, panned it with my hat, to bring up just an ordinary charcoal, to heat the iron I had to bend it over these single trees. Well, I'd get $1.50 a day when I worked for the company, and when I worked on my own, I got 10 cents a log. I was there 42 days. And there's where a polecat came in our camp one time. It was only a pole leaning on two forks and then against a tree and a tarp over the top. That was our camp. We cooked on open fire while the coals were maybe a foot deep. Big fire because we burned a lot of oak. Polecat came in there one night and somebody said, "Grab the dogs." I had two. One of our co-workers' dogs, he had broken a leg and he was in the hospital in Douglas. So these two dogs slept on my feet. They warmed my feet at the same time they kept out of the cold. Well, somebody yelled out, "Grab the dogs, skunk, skunk." Too late. One of the dogs got away and started to chew skunk. That settled everything. Flour, sugar, coffee, our clothes that was hanging, our extra clothes, my hat, everything. When morning came, I was the only one with bedroom slippers. And there were eight of us. And every day, a different man had to get up and start the fire. So the rest would get up and run to the fire and put on their clothes. Well, this man, he set the coffee in the cold, big coffee pot, and then he'd sing out, "Coffee!" And about that time, I heard him outside, cursing, spitting, coughing. He had taken a drink of his coffee, but the polecat had really messed it up. Sugar, salt, flour, everything. Well, I took the rifle and said, "Okay, new coffee." One of the boys went up not very far from there. There's two or three trees, so it's called Madroñoa. Actually, to my notion, it's a type of wild apple. I found some of the fruit. Now, this is late in the early winter, November, when I went up there. And I saw some little apples about the size of a cherry, a little smaller, and I bit into one. The heart of it was just the same as an apple. The taste was the same. And the smell. Well, we used the leaf for tea. They made some tea and I drank a cup and I went down the canyon, but I knew there were deer down there. Very foggy. I went down about 4 miles just before I got to the ranch, the end of John Long. Well, coming back, I went down the road and then I started over on the side of the road, over the ridges, the barrancas. I saw a deer on a ridge, and it seemed like a mighty big deer, but she looked to be about 700 feet away. So I raised the sights on the rifle, fired, and I was a good shot. The deer kind of squinched down and took off. I had burned her back. When I crossed down the one arroyo and then up the ridge, and then another arroyo, and up the other ridge, the deer was barely 350 feet away. I didn't have to raise the sights. But in the fog, the haze, the deer seemed further away, and that's why, because it fooled my eyes. Lack of experience. This is the first deer I'd ever fired a gun at. My father told me, when you fire at the first deer you see that you fire at, you're going to miss. I didn't believe it, because I was a crack shot then. Shoot rabbits, running shots, knock them over. 3 out of 5, running shots. And they scooped pretty fast. I didn't think I would miss a deer, standing deer. Well, I did. So I went on up the canyon, back to camp, and the boys started teasing me. Nobody was working that day because there was no food. They'd gone to that man who had a broken leg, had gone to his camp, and the horses had eaten up all his flour, had eaten up the sugar, and eaten up the salt into the bed of the wagon, and they left where the salt had melted, left cakes of it, you know, and then kind of greenish, the horses had been eating grass. So they went and got this salt. Well, before I left, I told them what the devil they were going to do. I said, take those beans, put them in a gun sack, tie a wire on them, put some rocks in the sack, turn it into quick. Fast running water, do the same with the potatoes. Then you boil the potatoes and boil the beans, but keep those beans in that water a long time. They're all spoiled. We were 2 and 2 and 2. Two people together cooking. There was 8 of us. And when I came back, they hadn't cooked beans yet. They cooked some potatoes. Oh, they started teasing me, making fun. Here I come as a great hunter. No deer. No meat. I didn't say anything. I ate one cold potato. The salt wheel they had pounded on a rock was that green salt that the horses had left. But we were hungry. Well, I ate a potato and then I went up the canyon, up John Long, all the way up to where there used to be an old mill 40, 50 years before that, this lumber mill. That was actually the old Long before. Now, this is 1931. Take 50 years from 40 or 50 years from that, you can come back to the date. When this lumber mill was there. And they used oxen to haul the logs because I found some ox shoes. They were only half shoes. And old rusty wheels. And they had moved everything out. And they had timbered that land there. And the fact of the matter is along one slope where they had already timbered the dead stuff were. There were trees there already a foot and a half in diameter. And there were some bigger ones that they hadn't cut down. So I tried to figure the time back. But I'd say 30, 40 years. I didn't ask no questions about that. Well, I was going along a trail, climbing up to a bench, which turned into a bench, and five does jumped it up. I took a running shot at one, and I knew I hit because I heard the bullet hit. I walked up. And then her head was, every jump she took, her head was jolting, jerky. I knew she was hit. I found blood both sides. Large blotches of blood. So I knew she was hard hit. And I say I was a pretty good shot. I used to kill running rabbits. That first miss was just till my eyes had fooled me. But this one, I wasn't fooled. She was about 70 feet away when I fired. And then I followed the tracks. Now, deer tracks there were just like a herd of sheep had gone through. So this is where they used to come down and rest or sleep, I guess. Now, mind you, this is winter, so they'd come down low where it was warmer, more protection in those canyons. Well, this doe had run, and I followed the blood about 100 feet or more and then lost it. I couldn't find it. I came back, picked it up again. I thought to myself, here my father would really shine. That this doe's tracks, he couldn't lose it. no matter how many other deer tracks there were. The first thing you do is study the track, the difference, what marks, special marks it had. Every animal has, its hoofs has their own print, just like our fingerprints. This my father had taught me. But I couldn't pick out any difference. But anyway, I went all a little further from the blood and then wondering what the dickens happened to that doe. I know I hit her pretty hard. Well, I happened to look down. This shelf, this trail had been up this shelf, and off to the right, there were great big patches of what the Indians call chamis, but it's chamiso. The Spaniards call it chamiso, and the Indians call it, maybe the Spaniards call it chamiso, from the Indian name, chamis. And it's like a, something like soapweed, very brittle, and great big humps, the bigger this room maybe, patches of thick. I heard a little noise down there, and happened to look down, I saw the deer hind foot. She kicked her last. I went down and I bled her and pulled her up on a slope so that her head would be hanging down. I was really tired, hungry. I had some rope wrapped around my waist on purpose. And I thought to myself, I'm not going to pack this deer down there. Let those guys, if they're hungry enough, they'll come after. So I hung the deer up on a big oak high up where I knew there was bear up there, and that time I knew there was wolf, coyotes. I took some hair off the fur off the doe, stuffed it in my pocket, took some blood, and marked a cross on my forehead. Let's see how good they notice things. This tuft of hair was sticking out of my pocket, a woolen shirt that I was wearing. A big tuft to it. And I left the blood on my knife, so I started down camp. It was about 3 miles from, a little more, about 4 miles from our camp. Ah, here comes the hunter. Where's the meat? I said, give me some more of that madroño. They couldn't find no sugar, so we just drank it. It's a good tea, good tasting tea, just like ordinary tea. So I drank a cup and let them, you see, standing around with a tuft of hair in there. Nobody noticed. Now, all these were, the boss was from Chihuahua. There was one there, Federico Friend. His father was an American, his mother was a Mexican from Sonora. That's why the name Friend. He spoke very broken English. And he said his father spoke nothing but Spanish at home. So he learned after he crossed the border. But anyway, he was one of his, the closest to me as a friend, and he's the one that, you know, teased me the most. Finally, I said, you fellas don't want to eat meat? Well, sure we want to eat meat, but now there was two cars in the place. One was broken down in a dry tank. The other one had no gas. It was a good car with no gas. So 42 miles to Douglas, no way to get into town. We'd go down 5 miles to the ranch, and they'd relay a phone call to the fire station up in the mountains and into Douglas. Well, we had done that in emergency when that man broke his leg. In fact, I was the one that trotted down that 5 miles to get to that ranch to get a phone on, or a phone call for help. And the boss came after the man. Well, they couldn't believe it. Ah, you're crazy. Where? What meat? I said, I have a deer hanging over there on an oak tree. Do you know where the old mill is? No, I didn't know there was an old mill. I said, an old lumber mill. You go up there and you see the place where the lumber mill was, and off to the left is a big old oak tree. And there's a doe hanging up there on it from the one of the limbs. As high as I can get her up. Don't believe it, one guy said, don't believe it. That guy, the boss. This Californian is not a lot of boom. Started growling. And then Federico said, what the heck you got in your pocket? He said it in Spanish. He said, pull it out here. What is it? Well, that's deer hair. Well, I said, I pulled it off so you guys wouldn't believe it. Haven't you noticed? I said, blood. One guy says, still kidding, that could be your own blood. From where? I said, here's the blood on the knife. Maybe I cut myself with it, with the knife, and left all that blood on there. I said, You sure? I said, there's a deer up there. Go get it if you want to eat. I'm not going to bring it up. Well, three of them took off.